Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
That was one president, and a man who would be president, should be president, Bernie Sanders. If it's one thing he talked about that really connects with young people and formerly middle-class Americans, it's the destruction of that middle class and the continued momentum toward an America exclusively serving the oligarchs at the expense of the rest of us. Look at that new tax bill. Certainly the current administration and congressional majorities seem to have happily bought into such a new version of reality that the American dream is just over. That we have become quite like the government from which our ancestors fought to separate. Our founders envisioned a government of, by, and for the people instead of plutocratic aristocrats. Luckily, we are not powerless over our future. Yeah, Bernie didn't make it, but still, we are not powerless. All polls show that the vast majority of Americans are not willing to play dead and let the highly centralized, rather impressively selfish and greedy top one-tenth of 1% rule without resistance. The American economy is, of course, greatly affected by government policies. But as our guest today, MIT professor Tom Cohen brings to light in a new book he co-authored, we are hardly powerless over our country's economic future. He dares to spell out specific ways to create a sustainable economy, workplace, and labor market that works for everyone. Yes, pro-business, but not just the corporations. And even in this headlong rush to globalization, automation, and the decades-long race to the bottom. The new book is called Shaping the Future of Work, a handbook for action and a new social contract. Thank you, Tom Cohen, for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Bert, for the opportunity. I look forward to the conversation.
Well, Tom Cohen is the George Bunker Professor of Work and Employment Relations at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of the MIT Institute for Work and Employment Research from 2009 to 2011. He served as chair of the MIT faculty. In 2010, Cohen led the formation of the Employment Policy Research Network, an online think tank. In 2015, he was honored by the Aspen Institute with a Faculty Pioneer Lifetime Achievement Award for his research and teaching on business practices that contribute to an economy that works for all. What a concept. Cohen is author of Restoring the American Dream, A Working Family's Agenda for America, and the co-author of numerous books. I interviewed Tom a couple of years ago with the publication of Shaping the Future of Work, What Future Worker, Business, Government, and Education Leaders Need to Do for All to Prosper. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Tom. Please tell us about the purpose of this latest book, Shaping the Future of Work, a handbook for action and a new social contract. What is the purpose of this book? Who is the target audience?
Well, I think, Bert, your introduction to the program lays it out very well. As you said, I did this book a couple of years ago, but after the election, it was so clear that the world had changed and was about to change. And we felt that we needed to go back and be much more specific about what do we need to do to build a new, what we call, social contract that works for everybody in society? And we didn't want it to be just an anti-Donald Trump diatribe. We clearly couldn't predict exactly what he was going to do. We didn't expect it was going to be good. But took the perspective that, look, there's going to be a post-Trump era whenever that happens. Yes. Maybe sooner would be better, but whenever it happens, we have to have a narrative that was absent in that campaign, at least the General Electric election campaign, to say, here's what we can do, and here's how the American workforce and the public and those people who really do want a better fabric for our society, the actions that they need to take to make it happen. So this is really a handbook to say, here's a direction for the future, here's the way in which we can deal with technology and deal with globalization and deal with all of the inequality and turn the economy around, using the workplace as the focal point for the transformation and the turnaround.
You got you raise a couple of points there that I'd like to focus on first. The subtitle of the book is a handbook for action, and it's a good size book in terms of it's like 8.5 by 11, whatever. So it's bigger than your normal book. It's not thicker than, but just it looks like a handbook. In what ways is it a handbook as generally understood?
Well, it's designed that way to serve as something that people can use if they want to ask, what do we want to do as business leaders? Here are the five or six things that you need to do to build a high road company that can be both profitable and good for share owners, but also can build and sustain good jobs and careers. And then we do the same thing for labor. You know, labor has declined, labor unions have declined, and really need to be reinvented for the future. And so here are some steps that both labor leaders and worker advocates out there outside of the labor movement that are experimenting need to go. And then there's the same thing for education, because we need to reform education, make it more of a lifelong process. And then finally, government. And obviously, government is not doing anything constructive at the moment at the national level. There's lots of good stuff happening and some bad stuff happening at the local level. We need a strong new government policy that supports a more inclusive workplace and economy. So it really is aimed at, let's make this a call to action. Let's give a set of guidelines for where we need to go, and getting people to continuously add to that, including our students. So we have a section in there where they build their own new social contract through an exercise, and we report what they think needs to happen.
Yeah, and just, oftentimes people say, oh, no, it's so bad, it's so bad. You know, they just don't care about us anymore. What can we do? And having a handbook is a nice tool to have. You also use the term social contract, a phrase not in general popular current usage. If they're familiar with the term at all, it's probably from American history classes in high school. I believe the roots of the term social contract go back to the 18th century. What was its meaning back then, and how is it applicable to the economic prescription you are offering?
That's right. We borrow it from the political philosophers of the 18th century, to some extent John Locke, but really John Jacques Rousseau. And basically the idea was, what's the obligations of citizens toward the state or toward the government, and the reciprocal obligations of the government to the citizens? And so we just borrow that concept or that metaphor and say, what's the obligations of employers to employees in their communities and society, and what are the obligations that employees have to contribute to the enterprises, to the employers that hire them? We think that it's gotten out of balance. We had a reasonable social contract in the post-World War II time period, where as the economy got better and productivity grew, there were wage formulas that were put in place through collective bargaining and through more progressive personnel policies that said wages will increase roughly with productivity and the cost of living, and that's what happened. But that broke down in around 1980. You can see a real abrupt change, as we show in the book, that productivity continued to grow at a reasonable rate, but wages flatlined for the average American worker. And that flatlining, that gap between productivity and wages has continued right up to today. And we haven't put a new social contract that fits with the modern economy, the modern workforce, in place. And that's really the task at hand.
And, you know, I've used the word social contract before, and people sometimes look at me like I have three eyes or something.
Yeah,
people think we're all on our own, disconnected from one another. It is certainly not the case. What that social, that period, that amazing period, you know, everybody looks back with nostalgia, oh, things were better back then, no matter when it is. But the fact is, after World War II, until 1980, as you say, I mean, there was some relation between, you know, productivity and profits and earnings, you know, workers' earnings. What caused it to end after three fairly solid decades?
Well, the reality is a number of things came together that created that kind of change. First of all, it was the election of Ronald Reagan, and the fact that we had this stagflation of the 70s and people were fed up, and he came in and said, we're going to change this, and supported the Federal Reserve in raising interest rates to get inflation out of the economy. The effect was creating a deep recession and a flood of imports from Japan and others in manufacturing, particularly in autos and steel and related durable goods manufacturing and then electronics. So you had a deep recession, a shift in political philosophy. So you had a much more militant government attacking labor. So the air traffic controllers got fired when they went on strike. You had business now all of a sudden in a much more competitive environment saying, gee, if the government can take a more aggressive role, so can we. And there were more demands for concessions. And then you had at the same time, as globalization was taking effect through more imports, you had the growth of the high-tech industry, so that technological change was demanding a higher level of skills in some parts of the economy. That all has continued. And you got a shift in corporate behavior that said, look, we are now under pressure from Wall Street and from the financial interests in general and share owners to maximize shareholder value. And so we got this era of what's called financialization, where corporations really focused on just maximizing shareholder value in the short run. And employees didn't have any countervailing power to get their fair share of the productivity that they continued to help produce. And so that mix of things, that combination of things, was a powerful force to changing, putting the economy on a very different trajectory when it comes to wages and worker interests. The labor movement declined precipitously from the 1980s on to today, and here we are.
And if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a heavy lift, and it's got a lot of different angles to do it. We're talking with Tom Kochan about his new book, A Handbook, Shaping the Future of Work, A Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract. He is a professor of work and employment relations at MIT, where I never would have gotten in. Now, is it different now? You know, we talk about the Reagan era and the situations that enabled the kind of the flatlining of Americans' workers to happen. Is it about the same now? I mean, do we have more flexibility? Are we still pretty much there? Or I get a sense it's even worse than that now.
Well, I think the political conditions are obviously worse right now in the short run. We have a situation where Ronald Reagan was a very conservative Republican, but he had smart people and around him that
at least
kept the world safe, or we're understanding how to engage in international affairs in a in a sensible way. He had economic advisors who were certainly conservative, and they fostered the same kind of tax breaks for people at the top. But it was more, and certainly there was no love for labor, and the Labor Department fell into hands of people who sometimes didn't even believe in the mission of the department to protect and promote the welfare of the American workforce. But you didn't have someone who had campaigned on some basis that he was going to be the voice of the workforce and the savior of the middle class and so on, as we did with Donald Trump, which has turned out to be a complete fabrication is the nicest word I can put on it.
I'm impressed.
So you know, we are in a political situation that is completely dysfunctional, domestically, internationally, on labor issues, on economic issues, on social policy, and on common decency and respect for the fabric of our society. And so that crisis that we're in politically, I think, is dominating everyone's attention, and I understand that, and we've got to get through this, and we've got to try to limit it, but we also have to look beyond and say, all right, when we get an opportunity to address these issues again, what are we going to do, and we've got ideas on what needs to happen.
Very important to have a plan in place. Now, what are the challenges facing the American economy today is, of course, the huge income gap, which we talked about a little bit. My sense is, and I may be inaccurate, that the gap between the lowest paid worker and the highest paid worker, it might be similar to the so-called Gilded Age of the 1890s. What tools were effectively used to address that gap back then? Are there similar tools which might be applicable today?
Sure. There was the Gilded Age of the 1890s, and then we had a little bit of the trust busting, and that tempered it somewhat. But we got right back into it in the 1920s, and income inequality today is as bad or maybe a little bit worse than it was in about 1928, 1929. What happened then is we obviously got the Depression, and we got Franklin Roosevelt, and we got the New Deal.
Yes.
And the New Deal laid the foundation for the new social contract by saying, for the first time, we are going to have national legislation that provides unemployment insurance, Social Security, disability pay, overtime protections, and most importantly, the rights to collective bargaining, to join a union, to gain a contract.
Yes.
That laid the foundation for unions to then grow in the post-war period and to negotiate the kinds of benefits that we've talked about. We need to redo that, but we need to redo it in a modern way.
A lot of us traditional Democrats, as compared with the new Democrats of the Clinton era, very much look with fondness on the New Deal period. I wonder, you know, if you took a look at who the average American worker was back then as compared to who he or she is now, why do you think there has been no systemic overhaul since then?
Well, there was an image, and a largely accurate image, of the workforce in the 1930s was a male worker working for a large firm for a long period of time, maybe the whole career, or at least a long tenured employee, and it was either worker who was a blue collar worker, production worker, or it was a manager. And conveniently, these male workers had a wife at home who would take care of family and community responsibilities. Well, you know, so much of that is no longer accurate. Now we have a much more diverse workforce, diverse on all dimensions of race, on gender for sure, and on immigrant status. More immigrants in the in the workforce today than even then, and we have a blurring of the lines between workers and managers and professionals and occupations that are somewhat somewhere in between. And we don't have the long tenure. We have more people moving across jobs over the course of their career than ever before. And so we have to adapt to those changes in the workforce and the changes in the way in which work is structured. you know, it used to be, and somebody asked somebody, well, where do you work or who do you work? Well, I work for General Motors, or I work for General Electric, or I work for the local hospital, or I work for the hotel down the street that might be a Marriott, or it might be a Hilton, or it might be a local hotel. Well, today, the reality is a lot of people have multiple employers and multiple jobs, because that same hotel might be called a Hilton, but it probably is not managed by Hilton. It's probably managed by some operating company, or maybe some private equity firm that actually owns it and then hires a management organization to operate it. And then a lot of the work might be contracted out. So if you're a housekeeper working in there, you may be working for some contract agency. And who's taking care of making sure that there's no violations of safety and health, and that you're getting the right overtime or minimum wage protections, or protections against discrimination or harassment? Well, you know, it's not clear, because they all say, oh, it's the other guys who should be managing and be accountable for that. So those are some of the challenges about the changes in the workforce and the changes in the way work is organized that we've got to adapt to, yet we've been stuck. And I've got scars from trying to work with government groups from everywhere since the 1980s, but particularly during the Clinton years and a little bit in the Obama administration. But we have an impasse between business and labor that makes it impossible to update our labor and employment laws to catch up with the changed workforce and economy. And so we've got to break that logjam. The only way we're going to break that logjam is by the workforce itself saying enough is enough. We need something different, and we want something different, and we're not all individuals just operating on our own accord. We've got to work together.
Wow, yeah. That's one great fun thing about history, is looking back at it and seeing the different angles. Like, did Roosevelt come to this stuff by himself, or did pressure from populists like Huey Long help make it happen? The pressure from below. It's pressure from below. I'm convinced
absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
No politician.
Roosevelt didn't come.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Roosevelt didn't come into his administration with a clue about what he should do about the New Deal. He was a governor of New York, but he was really an aristocrat.
Yes.
And he argued the same conservative economic policies as Herbert Hoover did, for that matter. But when he came in, he had to face reality. He had the growing unemployment that got up to 25%.
Right.
He had people in the streets. He had the people living in the streets, and there was a real fear of the future of democracy.
Yes.
And so he had to turn to a whole bunch of people, all of whom were pushed by these fears of a collapsing economy and a collapsing democracy. And what did he do? He learned from local innovations that came before at the state level. So his Secretary of Labor, Frances Perkins, the first woman cabinet member in our country, basically said to Roosevelt, you make me Secretary of Labor, and by God, I'm going to push for what we're starting to do in states like New York and Massachusetts and Wisconsin. I'm going to push for unemployment insurance. I'm going to push for some minimum wage and so on. And he said, well, okay, go ahead. And if you can help make it happen, I will support it. And that's where we got it. It came from lots of pressures from progressive forces, Louis Brandeis and others who were working with populist or progressive groups. You had states of Wisconsin that had a progressive government that had tried a lot of these innovations, unemployment insurance. Massachusetts had the first minimum wage. So all of that was out there, and the people who were instrumental in making it happen at the state level came to Washington to help design these New Deal policies, and that's the rest is history.
And of course, politicians, even FDR was agreeing with A. Philip Randolph about ending segregation. And he told him, I'm sure you've heard this story, that, you know, I'm with you, now go out there and make me do it. So change
has
to come from the bottom up. It does. And
once
we give up power, we lose. But we are not powerless. And you mentioned Francis Perkins. There was also Rexford Tugwell and economist John Maynard Keynes. Those ideas enacted in that landmark legislation, the Keynesian economics, basically, is that still applicable for the 2010s and beyond?
Well, it's applicable, but it's not sufficient. It's the Keynesian economics is a macro economic model that says, you know, you spend more money to get out of a depression recession, as we had to for after the 2008 collapse, and you try to build surpluses a little bit when the times are good. But so there's a macroeconomic, and that I think that still applies. But in today's world, we have to go beyond that. We have to ask, how do we make investments for the long run that have been ignored? Certainly, infrastructure is one that every economist who looks at it knows that not only is our infrastructure crumbling and behind every one of our competitors on broadband and other things, but it's a good economic investment for return on a competitive economy, and it provides good jobs, high-quality jobs in the short run. And so I think we've got to look at those kinds of strategies. You know, what got us out of the Depression was World War II spending.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's hope, God help us, that we don't get into another World War. What we need is infrastructure could be the investment vehicle that would really fuel long-term growth and create more good jobs. But then we also have to look at the more micro world that we're in, and that world is changing. The demands of technology, the technological changes are coming at a faster pace, perhaps in the future, than they have in the past. And so we've got to figure out, how do we harness robotics and artificial intelligence and big data and all of the associated new technologies that are coming along, so that workers are prepared to use those technologies, and we can create some new jobs, new opportunities, new inventions, rather than just displace workers and let them by the wayside.
So that it seems like, well, the government can certainly do the infrastructure investment, as you say, which would create, I think, millions of jobs. And I noticed that Bernie Sanders has a plan for Puerto Rico, which would rebuild their infrastructure, get them off imported oil and coal, and get them on what they have plenty of, which is sun. You know, and I think that's a model here that perhaps we could use, and that's part of it. And it goes, you know, beyond that as well. But it just, I wonder about, you know, it's a demand driven economy far more than supply side, I think. And of course, one of the many hurdles that Roosevelt faced was resistance by those who believed in some myth of rugged individualism and trickle down economics, which is amazing to me that they're still using that. It never had any reality. People in the 30s were concerned and warned that Social Security, unemployment insurance was socialism, which would wreck the private enterprise system. Many historians look back and argue, of course, to the contrary, that Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. I think it's threatening itself quite a bit. Now, and your book argues that to have a stronger economy, government intervention is essential. My sense is that it seems like similar arguments are being made today. They're trickled down. What was the reality then, and what is it now in terms of this stuff?
Well, you're right. There are historical parallels. The prevailing notion up until the 1930s was that government investment would push out private investment, and what you needed to do was to stay out of the way and let the private sector sort of heal itself through these deep recessions, or in that case, the depression. And that tax policy should be pulled back, that you should encourage corporations to make the investments and the economy will come back. Well, we are in a we're not in a depression.
No.
In fact, we're in a situation where the economy has been growing at not as fast a rate as it needs to, but the labor market is getting a bit tighter, and we are growing. This is the idea that we're going to somehow see trickle-down economics work today when it's never worked in the past is not only foolhardy, it's just dishonest.
Yes.
And it's just dishonesty that allows these proponents of this tax bill to stand up there and say, oh, we're going to balance the budget, we're going to get this fantastic growth, and the proceeds that companies are going to get from these tax cuts are going to all go into investment and produce new jobs. That, you know, when you can just as easily and more likely see that what they're going to do with a windfall from increased tax returns, they're not. If they wanted to invest and expand, they could do that now.
Absolutely,
they've got plenty of cash.
They do.
Instead, they buy back the shares. They give bigger dividends to share owners, and they reward top executives on stock options that feed on themselves. So that's what's going to happen if they get this tax windfall. Some of it will go into investment, I hope,
maybe.
But we're not going to see the kind of renaissance in the economy, and we're not going to see wages go up. If that was the case, corporations have enough financial cushion now to increase wages, and we haven't seen it.
They're sitting on so much cash. It's just unbelievable. And my sense is, and I don't know how this tax bill can be stopped where we are right now. It's moving forward, but maybe it will be. But it seems like what that's doing to any social contract is just what would be your words with regard to the go ahead.
It's gonna tear it further apart. I mean, I thought in the last election there was a genuine agreement that inequality was one, if not the number one economic problem, right up there as very close to the number one problem. And there clearly was agreement that we've got to get wages for the middle class moving again. That's all now been forgotten.
Yeah.
This is going to make things worse, not better, and it's going to exacerbate the income inequality because most of the benefits are going to go to the top 10% of the income distribution, and even more to the top 1%, because it's the top 1% that gets more of its income from capital gains than any other segment of the population. And so that's where those are the people who are going to gain a lot from this tax bill. But then there are so many other perverse provisions of this bill. When we all recognize we've got to deepen our investments in education, we've got to promote lifelong learning, does it make sense to now start taxing student tuition? Does it make sense to reduce the tax benefits of workers who take advantage of firm-provided educational benefits? Absolutely not. It's moving in the wrong direction on all of those fronts. And yet, the Congress it looks like it's going to do it, or the Republicans in Congress look like they're going to do it, and it belies both good economic analysis and policy and any sense of social justice.
Boy, absolutely. And I was talking to somebody very recently, a friend who was in, you know, the lower income bracket, who could see that this tax bill is like, the direct investment by the wealthiest, greediest, is being paid off by their servants in Congress. However, there's still an election coming up, and there's a lot more of us than there are them. So maybe people will get it. I don't know. And we're talking about difficulties here, but also solutions. And that's what's a little bit different about this book. Our guest today is Tom Cochen. The book is a handbook, Shaping the Future of Work, A Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract. It's like, once the Trump era ends, may it be soon, please, what do we do? We have to start getting to work and improving, you know, the social contract, people relating with one another. Well, what kind of new social contract is your book suggesting?
Well, it starts with business, actually. And it says there are two ways to compete in this country or this economy and worldwide. And we've kind of continued to emphasize what we call the low road. And the prototypical example, it's overused, but it's so clear and it makes the point, is Walmart. Walmart is doing just fine. Financially, it's making good profits, good returns to its share owners. And how does it do it? Well, it says we're going to have low prices, which it does. And at the way we're going to do it is we're going to keep wages very low as possible. And we're going to have high turnover. We're not going to invest in our workforce. We're going to squash any efforts to unionize. There are no unions in Walmart in the United States or in Canada, for that matter. And we're going to control that workforce in ways that allow us to be profitable. Well, that's one way to compete. But the other way to compete is to what we call the high road. Now, we have seen in industry after industry that for every Walmart, there's another model in retail. It might be Costco, where you compete on the basis of both low prices, but also good customer service. And to get that good customer service, you need to have employees who know how to solve customer problems. That means they need to know the business. They need to know the products. They need to work together. You need to invest in training and education so that they know enough about how the business is working and where the products are and how to communicate with customers and solve their problems. And so you get longer tenure, but much more productive workforce at Costco, and therefore they can support good wages. And it works together in a positive cycle to be both profitable and to provide good jobs and careers. That's the kind of model that we need to encourage and support a business in the country. And to do that, we're going to have to raise the minimum wage. We're going to have to take the low road away in some ways. We're going to have to really strengthen worker rights to gain a voice and so on. And we're going to have to invest in training and education so that we have this kind of productive workforce. And that companies can do that, but they have to be have the vision and the political will and the values to do so, and they have to have some pressures from their employees to make that work as well. So that's where we start. But then we've got to rebuild worker voice. We're not going to get these high road firms to spread unless the workers themselves have enough influence and power to say, this is the kind of company we want to work for.
Yes.
And this is the kind of kind of conditions that we're going to demand, and then we're going to demand that we get our fair share of the productivity and the growth and the profits that we help create. And so we've got to both invent the next generation labor movement, and then we've got to, as we did in 1935, enact a new labor law that will protect workers to engage in the forms of voice and representation that make the most sense today. So those two things have to happen, and that's going to take a lot of political work, and it's going to take a lot of pressure from the workforce itself and from the electorate to say, this is what we want.
I hope it doesn't take too long to happen. And I'm going to say two words, and this will fit right in. Market basket. 2014 in New England, that was an amazing bit of labor history, and I'm just imagining the lessons being taught in colleges and universities about that. What does the market basket lesson say about the kind of change you argue needs to happen across America?
Well, I think it's just a perfect example, because here in 2014, you find a completely non-union company, a family-owned business that is 100 years old, about 25,000 employees, 70 or so stores in New England, and it had a long-standing reputation. It certainly had a goal of having low prices, which it did,
still does,
but good customer service and loyal customers, and good jobs. It had long service employees. It invested in making sure that they could be promoted from within because they learned about the business and mm-hmm. how to make the business more profitable, more productive. And it really was the prototypical high road firm. But there was a family feud of long standing, and the third generation owners were battling, and the owners that of the faction on the board of directors that said, "Hey, we want to get more of the profits out of this business faster and more back to the family share owners," took control, and they fired the CEO, and there was this uprising.
Yes.
Spontaneous uprising by the senior executives, by the store managers, by the clerks, by the truck drivers, by the warehouse workers, and by the way, by the customers.
Absolutely.
That said, we're going to go on strike.
Yep.
And we're not going to come back until you bring the CEO who believes in the organization that we all helped to create over the last many years, and bring that CEO back so we can save this company from the kind of movement toward this shareholder value oriented operation, or even worse, sell it to some other private investor that will lead it down that path. So it took 6 weeks, but public demonstrations, and the fundamental thing that this lesson taught us is the American public, the customers themselves, the community members, the media, the people who were observing this, have a thirst for a good company like that. And when they see it being destroyed, they say, "This isn't right. We don't want to go in the other direction. And we're going to find a way to stand up and fight it." And in the end, they succeeded. And Market Basket continues today to function the way it had been functioning, with the former CEO in place, mm-hmm. with low prices, good customer service, and good jobs.
It was a wonderful thing to be a part of, to see. I mean, the customers absolutely just stayed away, completely stayed away.
Yep.
It was an amazing thing. And the power of the people was just, it's a heck of an example. It's really, it was very exciting to be part of that, I must say. Again, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Tom Cohen. The book is Shaping the Future of Work, a Handbook for Action and a New Social Contract. He's a professor of work and employment relations at the MIT Sloan School of Management and co-director of the MIT Institute for Work and Employment Research. Trump has talked a lot. You know, he said many things. It varies minute by minute. He can talk all he wants about reindustrialization. It seems to me it's highly, highly unlikely this will happen. How can we best prepare a workforce for a future in adapting to a digital and knowledge-based economy and the rapid changes in technologies, markets, and employer needs? What changes should we be expecting, and how can we, you know, make the most of this?
Yeah, the notion that we're going to somehow jawbone firms to bring the steel industry back, or God help us, the coal industry back, it's just foolishness. And nobody should fall for that kind of rhetoric anymore. They know better.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we can't have a vibrant manufacturing sector. We've got to stay one step ahead of the changes in technology and be investing in research and development so that we can build the next generation of technology. We can be the leaders in transforming our economy and our energy sector to solar and to other forms of energy, wind energy, and others that still are in the developmental stage. Those are the industries of the future, and they're all kinds of other examples in everything from textiles, which is turning into a mixture of fiber optics and textiles, which is going to be a very high-tech industry, to photonics, which is using a lot of different sensors to control operations, all kinds of artificial intelligence. All of that is potentially an asset for us. Yes, it's going to change work, and it's going to require more skilled workers, and it's going to require different kind of knowledge bases. But we can adapt our educational system to provide that, and we can get on with the task of making sure that the next generation of technology is used to augment skills as much as it is to displace workers, and have a policy that really promotes the looking to the future. That's all doable, and there are companies, there are educational institutions, there's research out there, all of which is ready to move in this direction. All it needs is a government that looks to the future, not try to brainwash us into thinking we can recreate the past. Those days are over,
yep.
And we've got to adapt to it.
Yes, we absolutely have to do that. And, you know, one of the things that people say, well, if you get, you know, government involved, then you have situations like Solyndra. They always bring that one up, you know, and oftentimes startups look to venture capitalists because, you know, there's that aspect too. And venture capitalists only invest in a small portion of new employers. You cite other options for those who may have been turned down by traditional venture capitalists. I wonder if you could tell us about that, as well as, you know, we can't, I think to get government out of the solar and alternative energy business altogether is just kind of dumb just because there was that one mistake. But how can capital be there for startup businesses that create jobs?
Well, first, on the government part, the government's job is to invest in good, solid research and development, and then hold companies accountable once they start to create jobs, to create those jobs and to sustain them here in the United States. And it's time that we do have a policy that really supports investment, but then holds companies accountable when they get subsidized to develop these new products. And the energy sector right. is the logical one, because it's going to take massive investment and a certainty that there's going to be a market for solar panels and for wind energy and for the other forms that are coming along, and government has a role to play there. But then on the private side, you know, the venture capital industry is part of our problem. I mean, it's great that they are out there supporting startups that are largely the high-tech startups, but they're demanding a short-term return, and they're not really investing for the long haul. So we need to find new vehicles for investment that are more patient, that see the fact that it takes a while to build strong businesses, and we've got to have entrepreneurs who are in it for the long haul, not in it to flip the business in 3 or 4 or 5 years to make their pocket full of wealth, but really want to build the next generation big companies. And so that requires more patient capital. It requires recognizing that you've got to build good jobs in right from the beginning in these businesses, and a mindset that says we're in it for the long haul. We're beginning to see a little bit more of that. Some people call it social impact investing, but even some of the venture capitalists and the other financial institutions are looking around the country now and saying, we can't just focus on Silicon Valley or here in Massachusetts and in around MIT and Harvard and all of that and the other favorite high-tech sectors. Let's go to where the jobs really are needed, where the communities have been devastated, and ask what are the comparative advantages that these areas might have, and what do they need? So if you go to Appalachia, what do they need? They need broadband. They need better infrastructure so that they can take advantage of people who might have the skills and talents to build some new local industries there. Not the high technology Silicon Valley stuff, but stuff that really works in that community, or in the same in the Midwest. And so I think much more decentralized capital formation and supports are going to be needed as we go forward.
I must say, I like a lot about decentralization. There's globalization that's happening now, and automation. Those two are causing significant disruptions, globalization and automation. Now, I had never heard of something called wage insurance. What is wage insurance?
Wage insurance is simply saying there are going to be some people who are going to be displaced And I don't know that you can separate out whether they're going to be displaced by globalization or automation, because the two are intertwined. The technology allows, supports companies to be able to go and move production overseas and so on. So trying to figure out which is the culprit is a losing battle. But we should be in a situation where we're saying there are a lot of benefits from globalization and technological innovation, but those benefits tend to go to people in the upper ends of the income distribution because they get cheaper products and they're the ones who buy a lot of this, and they get better corporate profits and they're the ones who own shares in companies and so on, and have sizable 401k plans and so on. So if there are beneficiaries, then there are also losers in this process. There are people who are displaced, who can't get as good a job as they probably lost, and they may be suffering an income loss for the long haul. We know that that's the case already. So maybe, yes, we should try to retrain people, and we should invest in efforts to rebuild their income-earning potential, but perhaps we just have to bite the bullet and say some form of wage insurance, at least in a transition period, to say, okay, if we need to retrain them, they need to have some stability in their family situation and in their living standards so that they can continue to go and get the training that they need, and their family can be supported, and their children can stay in school, most importantly, so that they can get the kind of education needed to be competitive when they are ready to enter the labor force. So so wage insurance says if I lose a job that's paying $20 an hour and I only get one that's paying $10 an hour, we will provide through an insurance, extended unemployment insurance or some other vehicle, some of the difference in that wage for a period of time, so that the person doesn't experience and the family doesn't experience such a big income loss. Mm. Now, that's a wage subsidy. There's no question. It's a wage subsidy to corporations as well as it is to employees.
Yeah.
And so it's not uncontroversial, but I do think it's a policy. It's not the solution,
right,
but it's a policy option that deserves not only serious consideration, but some real testing on a large scale to see if it will stabilize and share the benefits of technological change more equitably with those who bear the costs.
Yeah, and it seems like an updating of unemployment insurance. It's like, yeah, just moving from the 30s, where it was a great idea and pretty radical then, and just updating it, fitting it to our current situation. And I'm hoping it's possible that artificial intelligence and robotics can be used for the advantage of humans and not just the top brass. I get the sense from what you're saying is that with collaboration, maybe between businesses, the government, the university, things like that can happen?
Absolutely, and I think there are a lot of us here at MIT who now are beginning to ask, how do we use technology to augment work and to be more supportive and to be more inclusive in its benefits? And even the technologists, the people who are in our artificial intelligence units here, are beginning to ask that question. And there are ways to do that. If you look in the healthcare area, for example, a lot of artificial intelligence and so-called big data are now being used in diagnosing illnesses and figuring out what the best treatment regime and drug treatments and so on ought to be. Well, with better information, that can really support doctors and nurses and technicians and the medical assistants in doing their work in communicating with patients to keep them healthier and keep them out of the hospital and come up with better treatment options for them at perhaps even lower cost. So that's a way that artificial intelligence is not going to eliminate doctors, and it's not going to eliminate nurses, but it's going to change how they work, and it's going to allow more information to be processed, and maybe it can upgrade the medical assistance, as we're seeing in some progressive clinics and healthcare organizations, so that the medical assistants now can use that information, and they can reach out to patients in their homes and through telemedicine and other things and saying, look, I've noticed you haven't been filling your prescriptions, or you haven't come in for your checkup, or you haven't come in and gotten this treatment that you need on a periodic basis. What's going on, and how can we help you stay healthy out there? That's the future of healthcare, and it can be augmented by innovation and artificial intelligence, and it can lower our costs and improve the quality and keep ourselves healthier. Will it reduce or eliminate some jobs? Well, yes. Some jobs will go away,
right.
Like the people who did all the medical chart work when it was all paper. Well, we don't need people to do that because that's all now automated. But those people can be retrained,
right.
And put to work in these other activities that are coming online. And so this is an example where I think there's tremendous possibility to improve the quality of care, quality of jobs, and to use technology.
The fluidity is very impressive, you know, that automation, it's scary. Yeah, okay, some people lose their jobs, but the possibilities of it really helping all of us and being put to work for all of us, you know, there is that possibility. And it sounds like you and I both retain some degree of optimism that it could be. I don't see any real solutions now coming without real collaboration between business, labor, government over a sustained period of time. I haven't seen this happening lately. Are there efforts in Congress of which I'm not aware? And is there precedent for such a new social contract, this new collaboration of the various different entities? How can we, the people, help make this happen?
Well, we have to be vocal. We have to get out there and demand it. These are all possibilities, and that's why we say, yes, we need all these parties to come together. They're not going to come together until we insist on it. It's not happening in Washington today. You're seeing some progress at the local level and at state government levels, but it's not until the workforce itself says, we're going to insist on this, that we're really going to see progress. That's what that book's about. That's what I teach in my online class. It's free. Anyone who wants to take it can participate in it. And I'm hoping that we can use all of these mechanisms to get the word out. Your program is a great example of getting the word out on these issues. Let's get people energized to take action and then demand that our elected officials, that their corporate employers, and that their labor representatives today and in the future are held accountable for helping to make this happen.
How could people find out about that course? That sounds fascinating.
That course is just go on the MITx platform. Just Google MITx and then Google Shaping the Future of Work, and you'll find a course that's open to anyone. All the materials are there, and I'll teach it again in the spring, in March. But the previous course materials are all available, the videos, and the chapters of this book will be made available free.
Wow, fantastic. We appreciate your work. Shaping the Future of Work, a handbook for action and a new social contract. Our guest has been its co-author, Thomas Kochan. Thank you so much for providing this reason for optimism a little bit. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Bert, and you keep up the good work.
All right, I'll try.
Take care.
All
bye-bye.
Right. Thank you. The Work Song. Paul Butterfield.